This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and today our guest is Tim Vidal. Tim has an amazing story of resilience, drive, dedication. I mean, he went from being homeless in high school to becoming a successful businessman and accomplished physical therapist. We discuss his gift of building relationships and how that opened so many doors for him taking time to do that. He has created a successful company that continues to grow and prosper. We also touched on his experience of being a very small minority in our profession and his strategy to be seen more to kids so that they can imagine being a physical therapist. Tim is inspiring. I just really enjoyed this discussion, getting to know him better. So let's just hear his story. Tim, welcome to the program. I'm really excited to hear about your journey today.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, well, let's just kind of start by tell me where you grew up and kind of the early years. Just give us a little background of where you started this whole thing.
Well, in the early years, I actually moved around quite a bit. I call Ohio home because that's kind of where I spent the majority of my formative years and where I went to high school. But prior to moving to Ohio, I lived a little bit of everywhere, North and South Carolina. Both of my parents are Trinidadian. So I actually spent a large portion of my childhood living in Trinidad. And I lived a little bit in Florida as well before we actually landed in Ohio.
But, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So moved around quite a bit.
Tim, share with us a little bit what it was like growing up in Ohio and some of your personal experiences during that time as a kid.
It was a pretty interesting time. During that period of time when I was growing up in Youngstown, it was, really, really rough, rough city that at the time was the murder capital of the country per capita. And so very violent and, a lot of trouble to get into. So on top of that, during that period of time, my family was actually homeless. And we lived in a shelter run by nuns, in the city. And, we lived there pretty much the entire time I was in high school. And so that was just another, barrier I had to deal with when, during that period of time in my life where, like my friends or people at school, didn't know that that was my situation and I had to act like, everything was okay, and I just show up to school every day when, really the truth is one of the main reasons I went to school every day was because there was food there.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's just, that's amazing. I mean, you almost couldn't be yourself or share your story without fear of being judged.
Yeah.
And how do you think that, what was that experience do for you as you go forward here? I mean, it's that, a lot of people that would say that that's, that was hard to break out of. And how did you do it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, it set me at quite a disadvantage. But it made me resilient and it made me really appreciate life, appreciate things. Because, when you don't have anything, anything that you get, you really appreciate it. And it also made me, later in life realize that I'm not risk averse at all. Like I've been at a point in life where I don't have anything. And when you've already been to where you don't have anything, you're not scared to not have anything because you've already been there and you survived it. So that has really made me a lot more fearless in business because I'm willing to take, a lot more risks than, many other people wouldn't be willing to take because, I've already been to the bottom.
Yeah.
So it doesn't scare me. And I know for a fact, regardless of what happens, I'm not going back to the bottom.
Yeah. Well, and you look back on that and where do you think that, What influenced you to kind of break out of it? Was it a person? Was it your parents? Was it just something you had inside you that made you drive? What do you think the answer was?
You know, the answer is actually sports, man.
Yeah.
I tell people this all the time. You know, sports saved my life. That was, again, my first love, and that's what kept me busy, because I played, like I said, four sports in high school, so that kept me off the streets. It kept me doing something all the time. And, you know, the coaches that I had were really, really good. Some of the, you know, even with the higher levels of competition that I've experienced, my high school coaches still were some of the best coaches I've ever had, and, helped really guide my life. And so I think, those things were really the main drivers in being able to get out. Because like I said, I was able to go to college and run track very far away from my hometown. And that was because of sports, being involved in sports and having the good quality of coaches that I had.
Yeah. Well, that's an amazing story. And thank you. I know it's very personal, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. Amazing to think about and hear you lived it. So thanks for sharing.
Yeah, definitely. I think, people meet you where you are, and, they think that you've always been there and always been that way. And, when I share this part of my story with people, people are always kind of taken aback. Like, I had no idea. Like, I can't even believe that you are how you are now and you lived that way. You had to go through that. And I think that just goes to show you that, you put your mind to it, you stick to it, you give yourself a goal and stick to it, you can make anything happen.
Well, we're certainly made up of all our experiences, and they're never equal and they're never the same. So it's just, it's a great learning experience for all of us to hear others people's, what they've been through and how they work through it. So again, thank you for sharing that.
Definitely.
And it seemed like you had quite an accomplished athletic career, both in high school and college. So share with us a little bit about those experiences.
Oh yeah, sure. So high school was a ton of fun. Like I said, I'm from Youngstown, Ohio. That's where I attended high school. Ohio is a big football state. And the Youngstown specifically, where my hometown, that's a hotbed of talent for football. So naturally I played football in high school. I also played basketball, track, and bowling while in high school.
Bowling?
And yeah. Okay. So that one always throws people off.
yeah.
So yeah. Okay. Basketball and bowling were both a winter sport, so I was able to do both.
Okay.
So that was cool too. And just, to give a quick shout out, because we're at that time of the year, just 2 days ago, on December 1st, was actually the 21st anniversary of when my high school football team won our first state championship.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah. And as fate would have it, my high school is back in the state championship today for a chance to win a fifth title. So,
wow.
Yeah, like I said, a lot of talent in football there.
Yeah, what position were you in football?
I played receiver and corner.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Okay, so then you went on to college, and I think you were a track athlete in college. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, so I actually gave up the helmet and pads and, kept the track spikes. And so I went to Florida A&M for undergrad, ran track there for 4 years. My main event was the 400-meter hurdles. And while I was there, my coach saw something and decided to make me a decathlete as well. So I ended up doing a decathlon too.
Oh, wow. Those are probably the two of the toughest events I can possibly think of.
Yeah.
We always thought the guys that did the 400 meters, whatever, were crazy. So that shows a lot of grit on your part to specialize in that.
Sure.
So, yeah. So when did you decide that you wanted to pursue a career in physical therapy? How did that come about?
I was actually 13 when I made that decision. So I knew that pretty early on. So like I just, kind of outlined that, I played sports for, the majority of my life. And that was, sports was my first love. That's what made me happy. And I knew that for me to be happy in life, I needed to be in sports somehow. So it was either be a professional athlete or do something that would keep me close to it.
Yeah.
So originally I was thinking an athletic trainer. And we had an athletic trainer come and talk to our class for a career day one day. And it might sound bad, but then I found out they don't make any money.
Yeah.
So, I was like, yeah. Well, that's not going to be the route I take.
Yeah.
So then it was kind of back to the drawing board. And then actually like a month later, I was, in our football locker room, and one of my teammates was getting worked on by somebody. And so I started talking to him. It turns out he was a physical therapist. So I started asking him more questions about what he does and kind of what his role would be, you know, with our team and stuff like that. That was it. I was like, this is it. This is the job right here. And ever since then, I've kind of stuck to that and followed the path to becoming a PT. So here we are.
You know, I'm intrigued about that. It's interesting because, you're an African American, I'm just thinking about a lot of what I've heard lately is that a lot of kids say, well, you know, if they can see someone like themselves in a position in a career that they can identify with, that's really helpful to go there. So I guess my question is, was the physical therapist a minority individual, or did you just see beyond that? Explain that to me, how you kind of were intrigued to go forward in that field.
All right. Oh, no, he was not. He was white. When I think back, like, I actually never saw a black physical therapist, let alone a black male physical therapist.
Right.
Probably until college. And that was only because, and I really think so, was because I went to a historically black school and some of the physical therapy professors were black males. Having some of the experience that I have now and some of the knowledge, you know, I find that, you know, black males are actually the smallest demographic of physical therapists that we have. It's less than 1% of the total population of physical therapists. So it's very hard to find, like, you know, people like me.
Yeah.
So I really try to make an effort to make myself visible and to encourage my friends to be visible as well, because we don't know the kind of impact that we can have on people just by them seeing us and seeing us do our jobs well.
Yeah.
So, you know, just like that person did for me, like, I couldn't tell you that guy's name or the company he worked for or anything, but I remember that he was a physical therapist and that changed the trajectory of my life. So
yeah. That's really,
I think it's powerful.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we can get into it more. I was going to get into it later, but since we're here already, let's just jump in. I mean, you know, the physical therapy profession is embarrassingly, you know, lily white. I mean, let's be honest. And we keep trying, we talk about it, and we think that we need better representation, and diversity. And we haven't seen the needle move at all. What's your take on it from your perspective? Are we making progress? Is it a real issue in your mind? Where do you stand on this issue?
I think we are making progress, but I think it is very, very small. And I don't think that's necessarily to any fault of our profession. I just think that it's something that is going to take a long time for us to see the appreciable change that we're looking for. Research shows that critical mass of a demographic for them to start kind of perpetuating more of themselves is around 30%. And with black physical therapists being 3% of the total population, we're pretty far off from that, you know. And if we even look back at the amount of applicants that get accepted to PT school, those numbers are very disparate when looking at, you know, our counterparts of other races and other ethnic backgrounds. So I think it really starts from a much younger age. Like, we need to start talking to kids in high school and middle school and exposing them to our profession for that to become something that they even start thinking about. Because if we start getting to people in college, I think we've missed a lot of the potential future PTs, you know, regardless of race or ethnicity. But definitely, if we're able to reach, you know, black and brown kids and expose them to physical therapy at a younger age, that we have a higher possibility of moving that needle a lot faster. But, you know, we have to make the intentional effort to reach those kids and reach those people and, you know, and get into those communities, because historically those aren't places that we go.
Exactly. And so I go to, how do we do that? I mean, like you said, you made a good point that it needs to be exposed to people at a younger age than it is. So how do we get into those communities and get in front of those people and show what we can do?
I think the first thing, the easiest, the lowest barrier to entry, I think, is just like I said, people like myself, you know, friends of mine, people that are, first of all, not afraid of people that aren't like them, going and doing career days, you know, and getting in front of the kids that way. I actually started a program working with the school district in my hometown where we actually put physical therapists in the schools to help work with their sports teams. And as a part of that agreement, they also teach a class in the high school throughout the tenure of the student's matriculation, where in the freshman and sophomore year, they introduce them to sports medicine professions. So physical therapy, athletic training, you know, sports management, you know, OT, and any kind of discipline that can be found in the sports realm that isn't the athlete. We try to incorporate in that class. And then for the juniors and seniors, they actually get hands-on experience where they're in the training room with the PT or the AT and get to see what it's like working, you know, in this profession. And they also get the experience of being on the sideline for football games or basketball games and getting the help out there as well. And having that immersive of an experience, we found has really opened the eyes of a lot of students, and it intrigues them because it's not your regular experience of like, all right, go sit in the class and listen to somebody lecture you. You actually get to get out of the class and get into a training room and do some hands-on things and move around and see what that a day in the life is like. So we've so far found some pretty good success with that. And I think that it's a program that I would like seeing, you know, rolled out, you know, across the country, using our profession to, you know, one, use our skills and allow us to showcase what it is that we do, but also simultaneously giving back to those communities that don't have some of these resources available to them.
And you know, only being 3% of the PT population, as you described earlier, do you see that as a burden for you, or is it an opportunity? How do you look at that as, you know, trying to help move that needle?
So you're asking a deeper question than I think you realize you're asking.
Okay. go so for it then. Let's go deep.
Within the physical therapy profession, I personally don't feel that it is a burden. But in general, there is something called the black burden. And I don't know if you've heard this or are familiar
yes.
with it.
Uh-huh.
It's where, you know, when people of color start to achieve a certain level of success, that they're generally the only one in the room, and they then represent their race because they're the only one. And that burden is just kind of across the race and not necessarily just, you know, what we feel in our microcosm of physical therapy.
Right.
And because that burden is kind of always there for anybody that becomes successful, you know, I don't know that I feel it any differently within the profession. It just kind of is, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that helps. I see where you come from that. Do you feel like, you know, the events of the summer of 2020 have made a positive effect to kind of awaken America more to, you know, improved awareness of race relations and attitudes in this country? What's your feeling about that?
And I do think it was, you know, as sad as the events were, and, you know, we never want for those type of events to happen, that it did wake the country up significantly. What I want to see, though, is more of the continued action from those initial knee-jerk reactions to, oh, let's put a statement out, or oh, let's start a DEI committee or let's make a DEI hire. And, you know, seeing continued action to make the significant changes that we need to see across the board, because making what's now called a DEI hire then kind of cheapens some of what we're trying to achieve in the first place.
Sure.
You know, like it shouldn't even be called a DEI hire. But, you know, that's kind of where we've gotten. And, you know, some of it is, you know, we have to take the good with the bad. Like, we are making some progress, but we also need to realize and be sensitive to, you know, making sure that we're doing the right things the right way, and not just labeling things and making it, you know, a show of, hey, we did this.
Right, right. Yeah, it's interesting because kind of related to what you said before, I'm sure that you're in a position where, you know, just about every DEI committee or whatever that comes up, you know, you're probably asked to be on that committee. So that goes back to that, you know, gosh, you know, it could be an opportunity. It could be frustrating. It's like, gosh, do I have to do everything? So,
well, yeah, to some extent. And I'll share this piece with you as well. So I'm actually, you know, funny as you say that, I'm actually the chairman of the DEI committee for the Sports Academy. And, you know, how I got to that position is kind of interesting, because I remember being at CSM in 2020, and I was sitting in the business meeting for the Sports Academy, and, you know, they were going through the updates and recaps and all of that, and then they were, you know, announcing this new DEI task force, and I'm like, how is this possible that this is the first I'm hearing about it? Like, I've literally been the only Black guy in the room for like the last 5 years, like literally been the only one. And nobody has like talked to me about this, asked me about it, or, you know, see if I wanted to be involved or anything. Right? So then I approached Eric Mera, who was the guy that was kind of leading the charge on this. And, you know, I asked him, like, hey, you know, how's this going on? Like, I haven't heard anything about it. Or he's like, and he was pretty honest about it. He was like, man, really? I didn't know you, you know? So I'm like, how is that possible if you look out into the room and I'm literally the only guy? And he was like, man, I don't know. I didn't know you. So from that, you know, they said they were having the meeting the next day, and I kind of just invited myself to the meeting.
So I
showed up at the meeting, and, you know, they're going through and everything, and they were happy to have me there. It wasn't closed door or anything like that. And from that task force meeting, it got voted upon to become an actual committee. So what they did was, everybody that was in that room for that task force meeting, they asked to be on the committee. And everybody that was there said yes. And from that, then they, like 2 weeks later, Eric calls me and asks me if I want to be the chair of this thing. And I'm like, I don't know if I should, you know, like, you know, like, again, I'm the only Black guy here. So, you know, you're going to take the only Black guy and say, okay, hey, run DEI. So now I'm the token saying, hey, you know, listen to us, you know, we have something to say and we want some equality. And, you know, that was kind of my initial feeling about it. And after talking to him and doing some reflection for myself, you know, I agreed to do it. And the main reason was that, you know, I've always, like I said earlier, tried to make myself visible and try to do the work of my generation to help the people that come behind me. And this was a time where I was being called upon to be a leader and to step into that role and to be able to make the change that I've been talking about. And that's why I ended up agreeing to it.
Yeah. It's just really interesting. It's just the awareness pieces and the stumbling pieces and the, it's just interesting how it seems more difficult than it should be. But that's very interesting. So let's back up a little bit now. Sure. You went to PT school at Rutgers University, is that correct?
Yes.
And how did you pick that program, and what attracted you to that?
When I was applying to PT school, I went on to the APTA website, and I just looked for schools, one that I knew I wanted to go to, And then for the other schools, states that I wouldn't mind living in. All right. And so I applied to my first wave of schools, and I actually didn't, I got into one of them. Okay. And I didn't get into the majority of schools I applied to. I only got into the one. And I was like, I don't know if I'm comfortable with just having this one and this being my only choice. So then I looked back at that list, and I looked for whose deadline hadn't passed yet of schools that I didn't apply to. And I sent out a second wave of applications. And through in that second wave, Rutgers was in there, and I got called back for an interview pretty soon after the application went in. And it was pretty late in the process. So I didn't have time to go do an in-person interview because it was the time was so close to when school would start. So we did it over the phone, and I got accepted off of that phone interview. And because it happened that way, and I really liked the program, and looking through all the information, I really liked it, and I enjoyed the interview with the people that interviewed me. I opted to go with Rutgers, and I think it was one of the better decisions I've ever made, because it put me in a really good program that was small, that I got to learn a lot from, and it was different. I was in a different different geographical area, and I didn't know anybody, so I got to focus on school.
Yeah.
So it was really good for me.
Oh, that's great. And then not only do you obtain a doctorate of physical therapy degree, but then you go back and get an MBA. So what was your motivation to do that?
That's funny, too, because when I got done with PT school, I was like, I'm never going to school again. I'm done. I have the doctorate. I'm done. I'm never going back. But then I started my first company, my first practice, and I had an investor that, you know, helped me do that. And he was pretty well involved and a really, really smart guy, you know, a Stanford MBA. And in talking to him, I felt like I learned so much. And that was the kind of the beginning of me looking at the whole MBA idea. And I still hadn't made the decision yet at that point. And, you know, so I'm running the business, I'm bumping my head a lot, and I'm, you know, starting to contemplate going back to get another degree. And my, like I said, the whole time, like, you know, my goal was to work in sports and to have a sports career. And I found that not having an athletic training certification was holding me back from some of the opportunities that I wanted to have. So I started contemplating going back to AT school and getting a master's to be dual credentialed. So then I started having these competing ideas between, you know, do I go to AT school or do I go and get an MBA? And I had I was on the education committee for PPS, and one of my committee members, I had a conversation with him about this while we were on a break at one of our meetings. And, you know, he was about to start his MBA, and, you know, he was giving me all the reasons of why I should do this. And, you know, I took that conversation to heart, and that really helped. And what it boiled down to was that I found that going back and getting an AT degree would be kind of duplicitous on top of having a higher degree in PT already.
Right.
Whereas the MBA was completely in a different lane that would open up many more doors for me and give me a different kind of education. And that's what it came down to why I made the decision to go back and get my MBA. So it was, you know, bumping my head a lot and running my first company and really being intentional about what decision I'm making on how it will help the trajectory of my life after finishing that degree.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's quite a sacrifice and a lot of time and effort put into that. So when you look back
my wife will tell you.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So in that MBA experience, you know, this is kind of a tough question, but I'm asking anyway, you know, kind of in a nutshell, what did you gain out of that? What was it that gave you something that you didn't have before that you can credit to having gone through that process?
One of the main reasons I wanted to go was to learn about scalability and how I can actually scale a business. And I got that out of that program. The other thing that I really learned was negotiation.
Okay.
I had a really good negotiations professor that put us in a lot of precarious positions when teaching us how to negotiate. And I really took a lot away from that. So I think that the biggest two things were learning how to scale and scale safely and quickly, and, you know, knowing when to take risks and kind of assessing how big those risks will be and kind of what your return will be on them, as well as the negotiation skills. So those, I think those are my two biggest takeaways that I'm thankful for from that program.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for sharing that. So you started a private practice, you said. So tell us a little bit about your practice now. Is it one site? Is it more than one site? Just kind of tell us about what your company looks like now.
All right. So the one I just mentioned, I'm no longer a part of that. I divested from that years ago. So my current company is Momentum Sports Medicine, and we are based here in Washington, D.C., and we have four offices. We have one in D.C., we have one in Bethesda, Maryland, and we have two in my hometown of Youngstown, Ohio. So the company will turn three in April of 2022. So as you can see, what I just mentioned about learning scalability from this MBA program, I was actually able to put into practice in my business to grow, you know, as rapidly as we have.
Yeah, absolutely. And is it your vision to grow more and add more facilities to the company?
Oh, definitely. We have a few in the pipeline now that I can't put on record.
Yeah.
But
I get that.
But definitely, working to expand for sure.
Okay, great. So, and how did you, I noticed that you've worked with the Minnesota Twins and the U.S. Olympic Committee and some other sports teams. How do you get inroads? I mean, I'm always intrigued at that because, every PT, that has any sports inclination at all wants to work with those teams. So how do you get in and get their attention and get on board and convince them that, you're the one to have with all the choices they might have?
It's all relationships, man. It's all relationships. You know, I'll say, you always hear this saying, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And, I add an extra line to that because I think it's more true than the original saying. It's not who you know, but it's who knows you. Because you can say that you know whoever you want to, but if somebody asks them if they know you and they don't, like, that's of no help to you. And what I found in this journey was that the more people knowing you, knowing who you are, knowing your name, create some of those opportunities for you, because then your name gets passed around and it starts to come up in some of the conversations when jobs become available. So think of it like the college coaching carousel. Right. So like every year coaches get fired, and then every year there's some new hot coach that everybody wants. Right. And that name gets circulated, and then, he gets some big time job. Right. So then he's off the market. And then the next year, the same thing happens. Some, mid-major hot coach comes up and he's the name that gets passed around. So I liken it to that when you're trying to get in, break into these professional sports arenas is, getting out and meeting people, building relationships and building meaningful relationships. Don't just, get somebody's card and email them and ask them for a job, but start to build relationships with people, because when you actually have meaningful relationships, that's when people think about you. And you leave an impression on people and you're able to have some of those opportunities come knocking for you, because you're not going to get one of these jobs going on, Indeed or going on some website posting, and sending your resume in. Like, very, very unlikely that you're going to get a job like that. It's going to come from their networks, from their circles, people that they know and people that they trust their opinions, and then reach out to you. So it's not going to be something where you get offline or anything like that.
Yeah, it's just, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it really is all about relationships and building those relationships. But if you don't mind, take a specific example of one of the teams or athletic programs that you've worked with, and just give us how did you do it? I mean, building relationships, that makes sense, but that's pretty general. So can you just break down one and just kind of tell us how you did it, how you built that relationship, how you identified that person? I think it'd be interesting to hear the actual process.
Yeah. I don't think it's necessarily identifying any one person, because you never know where help is going to come from. And I think that was the case for me with, with the me attaining the Minnesota Twins job was, you know, it was a relationship that I built just because that's the nature of who I am. And I didn't expect for that person to be, you know, the reason why I would end up getting a job anywhere. But, you know, it indeed was. So just to break that down further, my whole approach, and again, like kind of going back to being, you know, young and Black and the only one, and not having anybody to look up to as far as like, you know, hey, you did what I'm trying to do, and you look like me. Like, there was none of that for me, right? So my whole approach was show up and meet people, right? And keep poking people in the chest until they ask you what the hell you want, right?
That's awesome. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, I started going to conferences. I started going to, you know, meetings that I wouldn't normally be invited to or get to go to meet people that, you know, are in some of these positions. And, you know, some people are going to blow you off, and some people are going to be really, really nice and, you know, have a conversation with you and give you their contact information and offer to help you. And you'll find that a lot of people will actually be willing to help. You know, it's just a matter of, you know, you being able to meet them and be genuine and make that connection. So, you know, like I started there, and then from those, I realized, okay, so these are really good people to know, but I don't know if these are necessarily the groups of people that I need to meet to get to where I want to go to. So I started looking at other avenues, right? So one of the things I did was like start going to like combines, right? Like the NFL combine or the NBA combine, or, you know, things like that, where like the people that are in these jobs are there, right? Because sometimes we go to a lot of our PT conferences and whatnot, and people are in season, so they can't come to these conferences. You know, so you get to go to some of these things and meet some of those people, and really see that, hey, there's, you know, a person that is doing this, that, you know, this is their day to day, and ask the questions, and not just ask, hey, how do I get your job? But like, get to know people, you know, because even though they're in a job for XYZ team, like, that's not necessarily a job you're going after, but they might know of another team who their PT or their AT just left. And they're like, hey, Tim, like, I know about this opening over here. This is about to become open because my friend over there is getting a promotion. Do you think you might be interested in this? All right. And then they get your resume and send it over to their friend over there. And now your name and your resume is in front of the person that needs to know it to be able to hire you. All right. And that just comes from putting yourself out there and being in places where you can meet people that are in some of these positions. So it's not always the conventional way, and you have to sometimes get out of your own way of being shy or being timid about meeting people, and going into places where you literally don't know anybody, to, you know, start, you know, striking up conversations and building those relationships. And I mean, that's literally what I did, because I didn't know anybody when I started.
Yeah, that's such a great story. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, it's so true. There's so many people that are looking for the formula, like, okay, tell me how to do this so I can get that. And a lot of times my advice to that is it's a process. It's just, you never know who you're going to talk to and whether that's going to pan out. And you just keep doing as you describe, doing what you're doing. And then, you know, sometimes they work out and sometimes they fall flat, but it's just that process of getting yourself out there, getting known, and also showing a willingness to just be present and offer your knowledge and you know, not ask for anything in return right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that thanks for sharing that. So tell us a little bit about some of the sports teams that you do work with. We mentioned the Twins. What other organizations and teams have you worked with?
So, like you mentioned, I worked with the Olympic Committee before. So I was part of Team USA for the 2015 Pan American Games in Toronto. And I still think to this day, that's probably been my, you know, proudest, you know, professional achievement of being able to, you know, represent the country on that level. And that was a lot of fun. So, you know, we live in the village with the athletes, and you know, there's the poly clinic that's set up in there, and you know, literally whatever comes in the door from whatever sport, you know, we treat and we work with. So The way that the Olympic Committee works is that there is a national governing body, or an NGB, for every sport. And some of those sports have more money than others, right? Because they're bigger sports and they attract more. So they are able to have some of their own medical staff. But there are some of the other sports that they don't have as much resources. And that's when USOC backfills and provides sports medicine services for those sports. And we'll see a lot of those come into the clinic. So what will end up happening is those sports that don't bring their own staff with them, the staff that's there with USOC will get assigned to some of those sports. So then we'll kind of follow them through the games while they're there. And that was a pretty cool experience. So I got placed with softball my first time around, and that was really, really cool. So I had, prior to this, I had no experience with softball whatsoever.
Okay.
So that was interesting, but it was pretty cool. I learned a lot. And again, I got to meet a little bit of everybody. So there are team leaders for every sport, which is essentially your point of contact for that team. All right. And the team leader for softball that year, it was incidentally like a Black guy from Ohio, right? So him and I hit it off, and we were talking, just about Ohio stuff and all this kind of stuff. And it turns out that the very next year he got voted in to be the president of USA Softball.
Okay.
Right. And so that relationship, I still have that relationship to this day. Him and I are really good friends. But what that led to was that the next year, he calls me up and he's like, "Hey, what are you doing this summer? We have a lot of tournaments where we're going to need coverage, and we'd love for you to come and be with us." And that came from just being put with a sport that previously didn't have anybody, and doing a good job, and meeting people. And to this day, I'm still affiliated with USA Softball, still work with them. They still reach out to me if they need assistance and things like that. And, that was from that initial experience. So,
yeah, that's a great example of, again, a lot of people want to know, well, I want to do this, and so how do I get to there? And a lot of times you just got to keep moving and see where it takes you. It's hard to predict, where you're going to be in 5 years and who you're going to be working with. It's sometimes you just have to get moving and start meeting people, as you said.
Mm-hmm. And, I'll take this quote from a book I read. One of the books that I would say changed my life is the 10X Rule by Grant Cardone. And one of the concepts he has in the book that he says is, massive action, leads to massive results. So as long as you're moving and taking action to do something towards your goal, at some point, some action that you took will start to pay off for you and start to open doors for you. So it's just like you said, taking action and taking a step in that direction, as opposed to not doing anything and waiting for something to happen for you.
Yeah.
So take action.
That's great advice. Great advice. And then you're working with some rugby team as well, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah. So that was many years ago. That was actually, so the way that came about was when I first came out of school, I was toying with the idea of doing a residency. And I had the chance to talk to some of the people at Ohio State that was running the residencies at the time. And, they didn't only take people that were PTAT, they took people that were only PT. And what they did for the people that didn't have an athletic training background was put them with rugby so that they can get that on-field, hands-on experience with a contact sport. That wasn't football, because Ohio State football is a big deal, and Ohio State rugby is too, but it's not, to the level of football.
Sure.
So they were able to have a lot more access with the rugby team, and get that experience. So, I held on to that piece of knowledge, and probably about a year later, and I was trying to get some sports experience because I didn't have any, outside of, some clinical rotations and stuff like that. A chiropractor that I knew played on a semi-pro rugby team. And, we were just talking one day and he was like, "Hey, we need somebody to come cover our team for our games." All right. So I was like, "Yeah, I'll do that." Now, again, the only experience I had was from you know, my clinical rotation. But I was like, yeah, I'll do that. So, you know, I go and I do sideline coverage for this your rugby team. And that was how I cut my teeth, man. Like, I really got a lot of experience really fast doing that. And because I did that, there was a professional women's team in the area that, incidentally, this chiropractor was married to one of the women on that team. And so they asked me to come cover them, you know. So then I ended up covering both teams and did some travel with them and everything. And that gave me a lot of experience in contact sports really early in my career that helped out. So then when I did get my opportunity to go and do some things with like the Olympic Committee and stuff like that, I did have some experience on what to do if something was to happen instead of being out there cold.
Yeah, and that's, again, another great example of being present and doing things that you probably didn't get paid for and taking extra time outside your normal day and just kind of doing the above and beyond to get to something greater down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I tell people all the time now, like, you know, younger professionals that come up and ask me about, well, how did you do this? I want to be able to work in pro sports and do this and that, but I don't have any experience. And, you know, I always tell them, man, like, volunteer your time, because instead of getting paid for that time, what you're getting is the experience that you're going to need that's going to pay off later. And, you know, there's a lot of places out there that need your help. There's a lot of high schools. There's a lot of, like, lower division colleges that don't have anybody that would be happy to just have you there with some semblance of knowledge to help out, you know, and that gives you a lot of experience for just volunteering your time.
Yeah, well, that's great advice. So now that, because you're not busy enough, you're also an assistant professor at the PT program. So how did you get into that and what are you doing there?
Yeah, so that was a few years back as well. So I knew one of my goals in my profession coming out of school was like, at some point I wanted to teach. And I had no idea that it would happen that quickly and that soon in my career that early. So what I did, I reached out to the physical therapy program at Howard University to ask if they needed some help with like anatomy lab or something like that. And I didn't hear anything back. And then months passed, like into the next semester. And then I get a random email from the director of the program saying, hey, our muscular professor is leaving. You know, would you be interested in teaching musculo? And I'm like, well, you know, a little bit more than I was asking for, but sure, yeah. I'll come talk to you about it. So, you know, I did. And it turns out they actually wanted me to teach the entire course.
Wonderful.
Right. Wonderful. So I was like, okay.
Yeah, that's the key part of the story right there. You said okay. A lot of people would say, right. Wait a minute, I don't have time to do that.
Right. Yeah. And I took that on, and that went from you know, an adjunct position teaching a whole course to, you know, the full time position with the university. And so I did that for about 4 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you've also published some you're a published author, you know, in the field as well. So,
well, yeah, well, you know, just some journal articles that over time that you get asked about. You start talking to some colleagues and they're like, hey, we should write something. And so, you know, we ended up doing that. I remember there was I also wrote a textbook chapter some time ago as well. And that's kind of what led to some of the journal articles getting written, is because I had gotten into this mode of writing this chapter and all the research and all the writing and revisions and revisions and revisions before this thing came out. And I was like, you know, after all of this, work, like, I have to put some of this knowledge to use and get a little bit more out of it. And that's how come I ended up doing some more of the journal articles getting published. But that textbook chapter was a really interesting experience. That was my first time getting published. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know if I'll do it again.
Yeah. Well, that's honest. That's good. So, you know, you look at your resume and we've just heard this discussion we've had and everything. And, oh my gosh, you know, you're a busy guy. You got a lot going on. And, And I know you have a wife and a couple kids. So, you know, everyone's sitting here thinking, how do you have time to do all that? And how do you make it happen? How do you answer that?
Well, honestly, I was pretty bad at it in the beginning, man. I really allowed my work ambitions to take precedent. And I think when when everything hit the fan, where it was like, hey, I need to start paying more attention to my family, was when I really made an intentional change to be more present with my kids. My kids are young too. So it was, I went from, you know, being single, no kids, to, and like really moving in my career like that, to being married with a kid and not changing that mindset is what the problem was.
Yeah.
And it took a little time. And you know, some back and forth with my wife to really understand that, realize that, and make that change. So, once I, you know, finally put my family first and started paying more attention to them, what it did was it cleared up for me a lot of what I wanted to do in my career, because then I only had X amount of time to do things, right? And what that did for me was, all right, what do I really enjoy doing, and where do I feel like I can make the most impact? All right. So all of the other things, because I had my hands in a lot, like you just outlined, and you know, all of them weren't necessarily in alignment, but they were things that I was doing. So like now I've been able to streamline a lot of that into things that are in alignment and towards, you know, the same direction, a common goal that I'm trying to achieve. So that makes it a lot more doable for me now.
Yeah.
And a lot easier, because I know that I enjoy what I'm doing, so it doesn't feel as much like work, and I'm able to do it efficiently because I enjoy it. And so then that allows me the time to spend with my kids, to spend with my wife, and you know, have some of that time be quality as well.
Well, looking over your career, do you think that, you know, do you think that that earlier time when you were had your hands in everything, doing everything, you know, probably way out of balance, as you said, do you think that was necessary to get to where you are today? I mean, do you look at that as a step that, you know, kind of had to happen to get you where today, or were you just not managing it as well as you could have?
No, I totally think I needed that to happen, because I still, like, that's, at its core, like, that's who I am. Like, I like to have my hands in a lot of stuff and do a lot of stuff. But that, you know, having things all over the board like that, that had to happen for me to realize what I didn't like, what I like, what I wanted to do, and what I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
So had that not happened, I don't think that I would have had some of the early success that I had, nor would I be at a point now being able to streamline and say no to things that I don't feel is in alignment with, you know, the direction I'm trying to go.
Right. So now, as you described, you're just much more intentional. You say no to things. You don't do things that you don't want to do, like maybe you've done in the past. And that's just a more focused approach at this stage.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
So if I were to ask you or ask the people that work with you, what is your leadership style? How would you describe that?
I would say I try to be an empowering leader, and I try to make it a team atmosphere. And I am very particular about saying a team atmosphere and not a family atmosphere. Because in a family, you know, people do all kinds of things to each other, and then you just kind of have to live with that because that's your family, right?
Right.
And people think they can get away with it. Whereas with a team, if everybody does their job, then we score a touchdown, right? And when somebody doesn't do their job, then it's apparent because we don't score a touchdown. And in a team atmosphere, you hold everybody accountable to doing their job. And if somebody isn't doing their job, there's somebody younger behind you that's hungry, that's trying to get your job,
right?
Right. So you have to stay, you have to stay on it to make sure that you're, you know, holding up your end of the bargain and what you're supposed to do. And again, like coming from a sports background, like I think that that just gels well with the culture of what I try to build in my company. You know, creating that atmosphere of team and accountability and, you know, loving who you're working with, I think that really lends itself to how I lead in empowering, because it's not about me. It's about how great you guys can become to make all of us better. And, you know, like one of the ways that I lead in that way is like, I don't have a continuing education budget for my staff. Like you don't, or an allowance rather. I don't just give them $1,000 and say, okay, this is your $1,000 for the year. You can, you know, use that however you want. And then you'll get another $1,000 next year. I really invest in my staff. If you find a continuing education course that's $3,000 and you want to go do that, I support that, you know, and then they can come back and make the practice better. They can make us better because like now they know a different skill that we hadn't yet learned that they can now teach to us. And I think that makes everybody else better. So I would say long answer, but I would say, you know, definitely an empowering leader.
Yeah, no, that's well said. And I think it's, you know, you're a very accomplished therapist with your credentials and your, you know, that your clinical skill and so on. But there's also a leadership component to it as well. So since you learned that and developed that, what do you do for your staff on the leadership side of things? Do you pay attention to it? Are you intentional about it?
On like building them as leaders? Yeah, definitely. So as I grow my company, it is, there's going to come a point where I can't do it all, right? And I can't be the only person at the helm. So I'm constantly, you know, assessing and watching like my staff on what they're good at and, you know, where they're weaker, to see who, you know, who and how I can help develop and mold into certain leadership positions. For instance, I have a staff member right now that she, from since starting with us, she's only been with us, I think, 6 months at this point. But because of how she's felt since she's been with us, she's opted to go back and get an MBA. And I have supported that. Like, I want her to go do that. And because of that ambition and intention for her to do that, and for how she has already shown herself to be valuable within the company, like, I can see her moving into a C-suite type role down the line, because this is kind of what she's positioning herself to do and where she's showing herself to be valuable in that way. So I think it's important to, you know your people and know what makes them tick and what makes them happy and try to build around that. And if, you know, what I see for them isn't what they want for them, then I need to know that too.
Yeah. Well put. So Tim, usually at this time in the interview, I always ask a consistent question to my guests. So in relation to leadership, what is a pearl of wisdom that you could leave us with today?
Listen more than you talk.
Okay.
And be decisive when you take action.
Yeah, that's great. So what excites you about the future? What are you looking at? And, you know, I'm not asking you to reveal any company secrets, but what gets you up in the morning and what are you excited about in the next few years?
Just continued growth. So, you know, I will share this. We did recently just sign a lease on a new office space that we'll be moving into a new facility in the early part of next year. So we're going through the build out for that now. So that's really exciting. And staff is really excited about that. And, you know, continuing to grow, you know, we're in 3 states now, you know, and hopefully over the next few years, we can, you know, expand that to 5 or 10 states and, you know, really be, you know, a force and a recognizable brand, you know, within our profession and outside of our profession. So looking forward to that is really exciting.
Well, I'm sure you'll do it. I mean, just hearing your story and, And you've had some great success, but it's because of how you do it and what you do. And so I'm sure that that will continue. So, Tim, it's been really great talking to you today. I learned a lot. I think you have a great future in front of you, and appreciate all you do for our profession. And it's just been really great having this discussion with you today.
Yeah, thank you, man. I really enjoyed this, and I appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much.
Okay, take care, and happy holidays.
Yeah, same to you. Same to you. All right.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.